This is the 93rd anniversary of the Vancouver Institute. The Institute, a good deal of information is in fact on the brochure on the back, and I will just mention to you that there are voluntary contributions and membership information in the brochure. The membership is very modest, and it helps to defray the cost of bringing speakers to the lecture series. The speakers generously donate their intellectual work to the Institute free. The memberships are $10 for students, $25 for a single, and $35 for a family. The memberships can be obtained after the lecture outside at the table, and the memberships can be obtained after each or before each lecture during the fall session. I should mention to you that there's going to be coffee afterwards, after the lecture and the question period this evening, and so you'll have an ample opportunity to join the Institute if you're able to. I should mention too that if you join, you should bring along your receipt or membership card, because if you arrive before 8 o'clock, it allows you to sit in the lower part of the lecture hall. The lectures begin, as you know, normally at 8:15, and the doors open at 7:30. Because there is such a large number of people here this evening, the question period will be rather different from what it usually is. We'll go first to the overflow rooms and take a few questions there. You won't be able to hear those questions, I'm sorry, but we will then return to the main room and take questions here. The lecture tonight honors a well-known British Columbian, J.V. Klein, whose most remarkable career demonstrated his commitment to this university and to enhancing public knowledge within the wider community. He started as a cowboy in the Caribou. He became a formidable maritime lawyer and then a Supreme Court judge. He left to become the chair and chief executive officer of Macmillan Bloedel, then the largest corporation in the province. Jack Klein was one of the students who took part in the Great Trek of 1922 to move the UBC campus to where it is now. And later he served 3 terms as the chancellor of the University of British Columbia. The person who's to give tonight's lecture is someone who, in addition to his research and teaching in academic institutions, has done much to enhance public knowledge in the fields in which he works. That is very much in keeping with the goal of the J.V. Klein Lectures. We're very privileged this evening to have Professor Steven Pinker as our first speaker. He does research on visual cognition and the psychology of language and is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. He is a remarkable Canadian export. He was born in Montreal. In 1954, he obtained a Bachelor of Arts degree and first-class honors in psychology at McGill, and then took his Doctorate of Philosophy in Experimental Psychology at Harvard. And that's the university to which he returned in 2003 after spending quite a number of years at MIT. While he was at MIT, he held the position, among others, of professor in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences. And that's where the recognition of his research and writing began. His skill as a researcher, writer, and teacher is mainly known to the public through his books, The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, and The Stuff of Thought. His books have received a good many awards and prizes. I'm just going to mention a few. The Language Instinct was included in the 100 Best Science Books of the Century by American Scientist. How the Mind Works was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction and the National Book Critics Circle Award. And the Blank Slate was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction. Professor Pinker has received a number of honorary degrees, holds elected fellowships in 12 scholarly societies, and has been on the editorial board of a good many scientific journals. One of his professional activities, which he took part in this year, and I thought was rather intriguing, was becoming the chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. Our speaker is obviously a person of great energy who's been generous with his intellectual gifts. As mentioned in the brochure, in 2004, Time magazine named him as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. And in 2005, his standing as a public intellectual was recognized by Prospect and by Foreign Policy. Please welcome our guest, Professor Pinker.
Thank you, Madam Justice. It's a real pleasure to be here in Vancouver. In 6 weeks, I might be back with 60 or 70 million friends, but I hope not. The old story of the blind men and the elephant reminds us that any complex subject can be approached in many ways. And that is certainly true for a concept as complex as human nature. Anthropologists can illuminate human nature by documenting ways in which all human societies show universals of thought, behavior, and emotion, as well as ways in which societies vary. Biology can document how the process of evolution selected the genes that help wire up the brain. Psychology, my own field, can get people to disclose their foibles in controlled laboratory experiments. And even fiction has an important role to play in understanding human nature and documenting the recurring themes and plots that fascinate people in the world's myths and stories. This evening, I'm going to give you the view from language. What kind of insight we can gain into thought, emotion, and social relations from words and how we use them. I'll use grammar as a window into thought, swearing as a window into emotion, and innuendo as a window into social relationships. In each case, I'll start with a puzzle in language, show how it reveals a much deeper feature of the human mind, using specific examples from the English language, but examples that have close counterparts in many other languages, and that follow an overall logic that can be found in all human languages. So let me begin with language as a window into thought. And the puzzle that I'll start with comes from a delightful book by Richard Lederer called Crazy English, in which he notes, you have to marvel at the unique lunacy of a language where a house can burn up as it burns down, and in which you fill in a form by filling it out. Why is it called after dark when it is really after light? Things that we claim are underwater and underground are surrounded by, not under, the water and ground. So the first question is, why do languages talk about the physical world in such crazy ways? And the answer that I'll suggest is that there's a theory of physics embedded in our language, a conception of space in our prepositions, a conception of matter in our nouns, a conception of time in our tenses, and a conception of causality in our verbs. And that understanding the intuitive physics in language helps explain the quirks of language themselves, but also the mental models that humans use to make sense of their lives. So let me start with space in language. How do we, using words, locate an object relative to some place? Well, you could imagine a hypothetical, perfectly logical language that would do it as follows. Every preposition would consist of exactly 6 syllables, one each for distance in the up, down, left, right, and near, far directions, and one each for the angle of pitch, roll, and yaw. But needless to say, no human language uses this logical system. Instead, in real languages, location is digitized. Languages make qualitative distinctions like near versus far, on versus off, in versus out. And it's the contrast between the qualitative distinctions that tend to be signaled in language and the analog nature of real space that led Groucho Marx to say to his date, "If I held you any closer, I'd be on the other side of you." In language, scale is relative. We use the same preposition across to talk about the ant walking across his hand, a matter of centimeters, and the bus driving across the country, a matter of thousands of miles. And the meaning of there and put it there very much depends on whether the sentence was uttered by a brain surgeon or a crane operator. Third, shape is treated schematically in language. Now, in reality, all objects are three-dimensional arrangements of matter. But language idealizes them as blobs extended in one or more dimensions. So we have words like line for a one-dimensional entity, but also the word road, which refers to an entity that we think of as fundamentally one-dimensional, though we also recognize that it has a finite width. And the word beam, which we also think of as basically stretched out in one dimension, though we grant it a finite thickness. We have a word like surface for a two-dimensional object, but also the word slab for an object that we think of as basically two-dimensional, though we also recognize a finite thickness. Now, this idealized geometry governs the way we use our prepositions. For example, the preposition along requires a one-dimensional object. You can say the ant walked along the line, or walked along the road, or walked along the beam, because we think of all of them as stretched out in one dimension. But it sounds a little odd to say the ant walked along the plate, or along the ball, because we don't think of them as stretched out in a single dimension. It goes into the way we use our nouns. For example, most people wouldn't describe a wire as a long, skinny cylinder, though technically that's what it is, nor a CD as a short, fat cylinder, because when we perceive objects, we pretend that certain dimensions just aren't there. And it goes into our general sense of shape, what shapes remind us of which other shapes. As when a little girl said to her father, "I don't want the little crayon box, I want the box that looks like an audience." That is, not the flat 8-crayon box, but the 64-crayon box, where the crayons are arranged in stepped rows, like the tiers of seats in an auditorium. Another quirk of the way space is treated in language is that the boundaries of objects are treated as if they were objects themselves. We have words like edge for the one-dimensional boundary of a two-dimensional surface, which then acts as if it's its own one-dimensional object, which is why we can say the ant walked along the edge of the plate, even though it's odd to say the ant walked along the plate. We have a word like end. We can even say, "I'm going to cut the end off the ribbon," which, strictly speaking, a geometer would say is impossible. But since we think of the end as an object itself, and we grant it a bit of the adjacent matter, it becomes an object, and it's perfectly sensible to say that you can cut it off. Hence, in crazy English, when letterer asks, "Why do we say underwater and underground when the thing is surrounded by water or ground?" the reason is that the words water and ground refer to the two-dimensional boundary of a three-dimensional volume, not to the three-dimensional volume itself, and hence it makes perfect sense to say something is beneath that boundary. Well, why is the language of space so crazy? It's because prepositions divide up space into regions with different causal consequences. This can be illustrated by a newspaper story that I clipped out of the Boston Globe a couple of years ago. A woman who fell through thin ice Sunday and was underwater for 90 minutes died yesterday. The Lincoln Fire Department said a miscommunication between the caller who reported the accident and the dispatcher significantly delayed her rescue. The rescue workers believed that a woman had fallen on the ice, not through it, and that left the rescuers combing the woods to find the scene of the accident. So the difference between the preposition on and under, though it's a matter of just a few feet, had consequential, in this case, literally life and death implications. Let me turn to the way language treats matter. And languages tend to distinguish four kinds of matter: discrete objects, like an apple; formless masses, like some applesauce; plurals, like many apples; and collections, like a dozen apples. And these aren't so much four kinds of matter as four ways in which we can look at matter. So the same heap of stones can be thought of either as many pebbles or much gravel. We all know the expression about the person who can't see the forest for the trees. And in crazy English, letterer asks, "Why does a man with hair on his head have more hair than a man with hairs on his head?" Think about that. Well, why is the language of matter so crazy? It's because different words for matter allow people to agree on how to identify and quantify portions of the material world. We're surrounded by matter. How do you get two people to agree on what portion of it they are currently both attending to? something that we have to do in many spheres of life, such as in transacting matter at the supermarket. And it's not a coincidence that matter is demarcated in the supermarket exactly the way that it is in different kinds of nouns. Items can be, food can be priced per item, which is what count nouns do, by weight, which is what mass nouns do, or by the dozen, which is what collective nouns do. And indeed, the same mindset that we apply to chunks of matter, we can also apply to abstract concepts. So just as we can distinguish between many pebbles and much gravel, we can distinguish many opinions from much advice. And we apply the same mental flexibility to the way we conceive happenings in time. For example, let's say I ask you how many events took place on 9/11/2001 in New York. You could answer that the correct answer to the question is one, because a single plan was executed, or you could say that the answer is two, because two different buildings were hit by different planes at different times and collapsed at different durations afterward. Now, I bring this up because it might strike you as the most pointless example of semantic hair-splitting you could imagine. But in fact, it does have consequences, because the leaseholder for the World Trade Center held insurance policies that entitled him to $3.5 billion per destructive event. If 9/11 consisted of one event, he stood to gain $3.5 billion. If it comprised two events, he stood to gain $7 billion. And one of the reasons there's still a hole in the ground in Lower Manhattan is that it took several years for the courts to decide on how many events took place that morning. And so when anyone asks, what is the possible value of niggling over semantic distinctions, I say the value is $3.5 billion. Well, this is a good transition to the language of time, and in many ways, language treats time the way it treats space, and treats events the way it treats matter, as a kind of time stuff that can be located or shaped along a timeline. We see this in the many spatial metaphors for time that we use often without even realizing it, such as the deadline is coming, or we're approaching Christmas. We see it in some of the errors that children make, such as, can I have any reading behind the dinner, meaning after dinner? And we see it in the semantics of verb tense. Now, the way, just as language tends to digitize space in its prepositions, it tends to digitize time in its tenses. No language has tenses for precise intervals, like a day or a week or a month. Also, time is treated as a relative concept. No language has tenses that are reckoned relative to some absolute time, like the birth of Christ, or 1,000, or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Instead, location in time is specified in three regions that are defined relative to the moment of speaking. So there's the specious present, a term that we owe to William James, referring to a sliding window of about 3 seconds long that encompasses our general sense of what is happening now. So the specious present is the duration of a deliberate action, like a handshake, of a quick decision, such as in channel surfing, of the decay of unrehearsed short-term memory, and the duration of a typical musical motif, such as the opening notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which people don't perceive as a note, then another note, then another note, and so on, but rather they take in as a single motif that in some sense is perceived all at the same time. A second interval that languages like to distinguish is the past stretching backwards indefinitely. Everything that took place from about 3 seconds ago, stretching backwards to the Big Bang, is treated identically as far as language is concerned, which is why Groucho could say, I've had a wonderful evening, but this wasn't it. Then there's the future stretching until eternity, or anything taking place from about 3 seconds now until the heat death of the universe is given the same timestamp as far as language is concerned. Now, not only are there these locations in time, but there are also shapes in time, how an event is conceived to begin, to unfold, and to end. And like shape in space, shape in time is treated schematically in terms of a few kinds of blob. There are unbounded or formless activities, like to shake, which doesn't have a clear beginning or ending. There are punctate or momentaneous events, like to swat a fly, which we think of as happening instantaneously. And then there are accomplishments like to cross the street, which is stretched out in time, but which has a natural termination point, namely when some human goal is attained, in this case, getting to the other side. Now, the formless activities that language can express can also be packaged into bounded events. So just as in the domain of matter, I can take a mass noun like beer, which refers generically to any amount of the stuff, and implicitly package it by saying, I'll have another beer, namely a bottle full or a glass full, we can do the same thing in time. So we can take an amorphous activity like to shake it, and by adding the particle up, turn it into shake it up, meaning shake it to completion, shake it until the ingredients are thoroughly mixed. And the particle out does the same thing. The difference between wringing a shirt and wringing a shirt out is when you wring it out, you wring it until all the liquid has been squeezed from it. And that explains the mystery in crazy English of why a house can burn up as it burns down and why you fill in a form by filling it out. Finally, the boundary of an event can be treated like an event itself. Just as I can say I'm going to cut off the end of the ribbon, which is technically impossible, I can say I'm going to start the end of my talk, which also should be impossible if the end of my talk is the instant at which I shut up. But if you think of the end as an event embedded within a longer event, and you grant it a bit of the adjacent time, then it makes perfect sense to say that you're going to start it. Note that it is exactly parallel to why, in the domain of space, it's called after dark when it's really after light. Namely, the word dark refers to an instant bounding an extent in time. Exactly as in space, why we say underwater when the thing is surrounded by water. Namely, the word here refers to the boundary, not to the extent. Well, why is the language of time so crazy? It's because stretches of time that are defined relative to the moment of speaking have different consequences for knowledge and action. The present tense is basically another word for our consciousness, for what we are aware of at any given waking moment. The past is not just any old stretch of time, but it is that stretch of time that is potentially knowable to the speaker, that is factual, what happened happened, and which is unchangeable. You can't change the past. And one illustration of that comes from the Scott Peterson murder case a few years ago, in which investigators noted that Peterson used the past tense when referring to his wife and unborn son before their bodies were found, abruptly correcting himself. His use of the past tense didn't just put a timestamp on an event, but it betrayed his state of knowledge of the event. Conversely, the future isn't just any old duration of time, but it's that stretch of time that is unknowable, that is hypothetical, nothing has to happen, and that it is willable. We can choose to make certain things happen. And this ambiguity was exploited by Winston Churchill when he said, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall never surrender. That statement could both be an avowal of resolve and a calm prediction about what was going to happen. That combination is what gave the statement such rhetorical power. Finally, let me turn to causality in language, where the model of causality in our verbs can be summed up by this diagram. Namely, an actor directly impinges on an entity, making it move or change. And this is illustrated in a nice little demo by the psychologist Philip Wolff, who programmed a computer animation showing Sarah either pushing against the door and causing it to open, or lifting a window, letting in a breeze, and causing the door to open. If you ask people, did Sarah cause the door to open? In both cases, they say yes. But now, if you pack the causality into the verb and you say, did Sarah open the door? In the case where she physically directly pushed it, they say yes. In the case where she initiated a causal chain whose final link was the door opening, they say no. Well, why is the language of causality so crazy? I think it's because directly caused events are those that are most likely to be foreseeable and intended, hence those for which we feel we can hold people responsible. And when a causal chain has multiple links, our sense of moral and legal responsibility can break down. And this can be illustrated by an episode from American history. In 1881, President James Garfield was hit by two bullets fired by the assassin Charles Guiteau in a Baltimore train station. Now, the bullets missed his organs and major arteries and needn't have been fatal, except that he was subjected to the best medical care of the day, which meant that he was subjected to the harebrained practices of the doctors of the day. For example, probing his wounds without washing their hands first, and feeding him through his rectum instead of through his mouth. Now, as a result, Garfield lingered on his deathbed for 3 months before finally succumbing to the effects of infection and starvation. Now, at the assassin's murder trial, he said in his defense, "The doctors killed him, I just shot him." Not unreasonably. The jury, however, was unpersuaded, and he went to the gallows. But it is another illustration of the life and death consequences of the semantics of a word. So to sum up, language is a window into cognition. There's a theory of physics embedded in our language, a conception of space in terms of place and objects in digital relationships, a conception of matter in terms of stuff and things extending along one or more dimensions, a conception of time in terms of activities and events located and extended along a single dimension, and a conception of causation in terms of the direct impingement of an actor upon an entity. This way of construing reality differs from real physics, but it coincides with human goals and purposes, with the causal texture of our environment, with what is knowable, factual, and willable, with ways of packaging and measuring our experience, and with ways of assigning responsibility for events. Let me switch now from cognition to emotion. And the linguistic puzzle that I'll begin with came to light 5 years ago when NBC broadcasted the Golden Globe Awards on live network television, and accepting an award on behalf of the group U2, Bono said in his acceptance speech, and I quote, "This is really, really fucking brilliant." It went out over live television, the switchboards lit up, and the case was then sent to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which has jurisdiction in the United States over broadcast airwaves. Now, it turns out they checked their guidelines, and they decided not to punish the network, because indecency, which is what they are empowered to regulate, is, quote, "material that describes or depicts sexual or excretory organs or activities." And the fucking and fucking brilliant was an adjective or expletive to emphasize an exclamation. Well, a number of conservative congressmen were enraged. And so they filed legislation designed to close this loophole. And, well, I downloaded one of these pieces of legislation from the U.S. Congressional website, and I will now read it to you in its entirety. House Resolution 3687, the Clean Airwaves Act. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that Section 1464 of Title 18, United States Code, is amended, one, by inserting A before whoever, and two, the term profane, used with respect to language, includes the words shit, piss, fuck, cunt, asshole, and the phrases cocksucker, motherfucker, and asshole, compound use, including hyphenated compounds of such words and phrases, with each other and with other words or phrases, and other grammatical forms of such words and phrases, including verb, adjective, gerund, participle, and infinitive forms. Unfortunately, the fucking and fucking brilliant is an adverb, and that's the one part of speech they forgot to include on the list. Nonetheless, this raises an interesting puzzle. Why do people get so upset about hearing certain words? It's not as if they've never heard the words before. And in fact, it's not just a scientific puzzle, but it's been the main legal battleground of free speech in the U.S. and the U.K. for most of the past century. Indeed, in a few weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear another case based on the legality of banning fleeting expletives of the kind that Bono uttered on the air. Well, to understand this, one has to know something about the language of swearing, including the cognitive neuroscience of swearing. What happens in the brain when a person perceives or produces a taboo word. And the first generalization is that taboo words activate brain areas associated with negative emotion. These include the right hemisphere, which is more involved in with negative emotion than the left. In production, taboo words seem to involve the basal ganglia, which are two complex nuclei buried deep within the front half of the brain that are evolutionarily quite ancient and that are involved in the packaging and inhibition of behavioral routines, and which seem to be malfunctioning in Tourette's syndrome, which is in extreme cases marked by the involuntary uttering of taboo words and expressions. In perception, taboo words tend to light up the amygdala, an almond-shaped organ. You have one in each temporal lobe buried deep within the brain, which ordinarily respond to threatening stimuli, like an angry face or a dangerous animal. Now, the second generalization is that taboo words are processed involuntarily. That is, you can't hear a taboo word or choose to hear it as just a stretch of sound, nor can you choose to see it on the page as just a squiggle of ink. Now, when psychologists want to show that something is processed involuntarily or automatically by the brain, they use a technique called the Stroop test. It's familiar to every psychology undergraduate, and it's been the subject of more than 4,000 scientific papers. But it's actually a rather low-tech method. And all you do is people are shown a list of words one at a time, and every time they see a word, they have to name the color in which the word is printed. That is, not read the word, just pay attention to the color of the ink. And I'll give you a simple instance right now. Every time you see a word, as quickly as you can, name the color in which the word is printed. Ready? Okay. Okay, pretty easy. Here's another list, same thing. Name the color in which the word is printed. But much harder, isn't it? That's because for a literate adult, the reading process has become automatic, and you can't choose to turn it off even when the task calls for ignoring it. So that, thus, when the color in which a word is printed differs from the color that it spells out, because you can't not register what it spells out, that slows you down. Now, of the 4,000 scientific papers using the Stroop effect, my favorite comes from the laboratory of the psycholinguist Donald Mackay at UCLA. And the instructions are the same. Name the color in which each of these words is printed as fast as you can. Are you ready? It turns out that people are slowed down by this task almost as much as when the word spells out a competing color. So the moral is, or the generalization is, that swearing consists of using language as a weapon to force a listener to think an unpleasant or at least an emotionally charged thought. And that at least allows us to break down the puzzle of swearing into two puzzles, namely, what kinds of concepts trigger negative emotions, and why would a speaker want to trigger a negative emotion in the minds of his listener? And I'll answer those separately. Well, first, the contents of swearing. Anyone who speaks more than one language, including all the bilingual residents of this country, know that you can't translate the taboo terms of one language into another and get the same effect. That is, there is cross-linguistic variation in the contents of swear words. Nonetheless, there are also universal patterns, and linguists who have surveyed the world's languages tabulating the kinds of words that can become taboo, find that they fall into five basic categories, each of them associated with a negative emotion. There are often taboo words surrounding the supernatural, such as damn, hell, and Jesus Christ in English. And these have lost their sting in most Anglo countries, but as I'm sure many of you know, in parts of the world that are more traditionally Catholic, they still retain some amount of spiciness, such as in Quebec, for example, where the most popular taboo words are accursed tabernacle, now, or accursed chalice. And American audiences are always dumbfounded to learn that those could possibly be swear words in any language of the world. Anyway, words like this evoke the emotions of awe and fear at the power of supernatural entities. There are, of course, many taboo terms surrounding bodily effluvia and the organs that secrete them. You all know what they are. And it's not surprising we have an emotional reaction to those words, because epidemiologists tell us that effluvia are major vectors of disease. Many parasites find it convenient to hitch a ride from body to body on bodily secretions. We have evolved a defense against being infected by this root, the emotion of disgust, and that is the emotion that these words can evoke. There are many taboo terms in other languages surrounding disease, death, and infirmity themselves, as in the old curses, a pox on you, or a plague on both your houses, or the curse heard in Polish and Yiddish, cholera, cholera. And there's even a bit of taboo surrounding the word for our most dreaded disease, cancer, and one often reads in an obituary that so-and-so passed away from a long illness. Both the word die and the word cancer are considered taboo and are replaced by euphemisms because they evoke the emotion of dread of death and disease. There are many taboo terms in many languages surrounding sexuality. Again, you all know what they are. And at this point, people ask, how does this fit into the theory that taboo words evoke negative emotions? Isn't sexuality a source of mutual pleasure? Well, it can be when it's done between consenting adults, but when you consider a wider range of interested parties and a wider range of circumstances, then you realize that it isn't always so much fun and games. Sexuality also involves exploitation, illegitimacy, incest, jealousy, spousal abuse, cuckoldry, desertion, feuding, harassment, and rape. It's not surprising that people have strong emotions when it comes to sexuality, which we can call revulsion at sexual depravity. Finally, there are often taboo terms for disfavored people in groups, for infidels, cripples, enemies, and subordinated peoples, such as the most inflammatory swear word in contemporary American English, which is not the S word nor the F word, but the N word, nigger, one of a number of offensive terms for racial and ethnic minorities, which can evoke the emotions of hatred and contempt. Well, those are some of the negative emotions that words can elicit. And now the question is, why would anyone want to do this? Why do people swear? Or why do people try to evoke emotion in their listeners' minds? It turns out there isn't one answer to this question, because there are at least five distinct ways in which people swear. The most literal use of these words is in dysphemistic swearing, the difference between exact synonyms that vary in their emotional impact, like shit versus feces, fucking versus copulating, cunt versus vagina. Now, you all know what a euphemism is. The idea behind a euphemism is we have to talk about this for a specific purpose, but let's avoid thinking about how awful it is. Dysphemism, a technical term for linguistics, refers to the opposite intent, namely, I want you to think about how awful this is. And one way to illustrate this difference is to consider the 34 euphemisms for feces in contemporary English. Now, people don't like to think about feces any more than they like to touch it or smell it. Nonetheless, we are incarnate beings, and feces is a part of life. Every now and again, you really do have to get together to confer about what to do with it. There's no getting around it. Nonetheless, to make it possible to raise the subject while making it completely clear to your listener that you are not doing so in order to gross him out, you reach for one of these euphemisms, each of them specific to a context, making it clear why you are referring to that subject then and there. There are generic terms like waste and fecal matter, formal terms from Latin like feces and excrement, terms that you have to use with children during toilet training, like poop and doo-doo, terms that you use of diapers during toilet training, like soil, terms appropriate to a medical context, like stool and bowel movement, many terms that are involved in animal care, depending on whether you're referring to large units, like pats, small units, like droppings, the context is scientific, such as scat, or agricultural, such as manure, and in this heyday of recycling, the need has arisen for a term to refer to human feces recycled for use as fertilizer. And so we've seen in recent years night soil, human urine, and my favorite, human biosolids. It's kind of makes you wonder why people make so much of a fuss over how many words the Eskimos have for snow. Now, we need euphemisms. And if you were to select the wrong euphemism in a particular context, the result would be immediately obvious. Such as if a nurse said to you, the medical lab will need a doo-doo sample. Or you opened the gardening section of the newspaper, which said, for plump tomatoes, fertilize your plants with cattle bowel movement. But by the same token, we need dysphemisms for those moments in life when the point for politeness has passed, and you really do want to rub your listener's face in how truly awful some object or activity is. Such as, will you pick up your dog shit? Or the plumber was working under the sink and I had to look at the crack in his ass the whole time. Or, so while I've been taking care of the kids, you've been fucking your secretary. Strong words for moments in life when strong emotions need to be expressed. Well, that's just the most obvious way in which we use taboo terms, namely for their literal meanings, but there's a much wider range of circumstances in which these words are used for their emotional effect, such as in abusive swearing, where the terms can be used metaphorically to intimidate or humiliate someone. Now, scholars who devote their lives to the study of maledicta have noted that the sheer ingenuity that goes into abusive swearing in the history of the English language, and for that matter in languages all over the world. Indeed, all of the classic poetic devices, metaphor, imagery, connotation, alliteration, meter, and rhyme, are in full display in the crafting of obscene imprecations. For example, people are often tempted to use metaphor to liken people to bodily effluvia, or the organs and accessories associated with them, as when you refer to someone that you don't like as a piece of shit, an asshole, a dickhead, a prick, a schmuck, and so on. You can use these words to offer people advice, to advise them to engage in undignified activities, such as shit, shove it up your ass, or fuck yourself. You can accuse them of being the kind of person that habitually engages in undignified sexual activities, and for every undignified sexual activity, there is an obscene imprecation, including incest, motherfucker, sodomy, bugger, fellatio, cocksucker, masturbation, jerk or wanker. And my favorite from bestiality is a curse that hasn't been in use for several centuries, but I would like to see it revived. And so the next time someone steals the parking space that you have been patiently waiting for, I suggest that you advise them to kiss the cunt of a cow. First noted in 1585, but which I think is due for a revival because it brings some fresh imagery to this rather hackneyed domain, and also has, I think, a rather pleasing alliteration and meter. Well, even one step farther from the literal meaning of these words is idiomatic swearing. Strange expressions like shit out of luck, get your shit together, piss poor, pissed off, my ass, a pain in the ass, sweet fuck all, what the fuck, where it's completely unclear what those words are actually doing in those expressions. Well, what they're doing is they're being used purely for their ability to ping the listener's emotion, to arouse the listener's attention, to assert a macho or cool pose, or to express informality, to say this is the kind of setting where we don't have to watch what we say. And closely related to idiomatic swearing is emphatic swearing, such as Bono's "This is really fucking brilliant," and other examples I've collected, such as "He thinks he's a fucking scoutmaster," "Rip Van fucking Winkle," and so on. Now, many of us know people who rely too much on emphatic and idiomatic swearing to liven up their speech, leading to a form of the English language that's sometimes called fuck patois. As in the story of the soldier who said, "I come home to my fucking house after 3 fucking years in the fucking war, and what do I fucking well find? My wife in bed engaging in illicit sexual relations." Finally, there's cathartic swearing, the strange phenomenon in which when some misfortune suddenly befalls you, you slice your thumb together with a bagel or you knock a glass of red wine onto your lap. The topic of your conversation abruptly switches to excretion, sexuality, or theology. Well, what's happening there? If you ask people, they say it lets off steam. It releases tension, the hydraulic theory of the emotions. However, neurobiologists tell us that there isn't literally a boiler filled with steam and a bunch of safety valves in the skull. They're just brain cells that fire in patterns. And so the hydraulic theory is no more than a metaphor. A more plausible theory is the rage circuit theory, according to which mammals have evolved a reflex in which when the animal is suddenly injured or confined, it will emit a sudden angry noise accompanied by a furious struggle, presumably to startle or intimidate an attacker. And any of you who have sat down on your cat are familiar with this reflex. Well, the idea is that we humans have inherited this reflex, except because our vocal tract is also under the control of our language system, we don't just yelp, but we articulate our yelp with a word saturated in negative emotion that we ordinarily inhibit ourselves from producing. Now, I think there's a lot of evidence for that the rage circuit theory is at least partly true, but it can't be the whole story. Because as I've mentioned, cathartic swearing is conventional. You have to learn how to swear in a particular language. You can't just blurt out any old taboo or negative word. In many European countries, when you, in Romance languages, if you were to knock a glass of wine over, you might yell out whore or cunt. In English, those are terms that arouse negative emotion, but it's just not what you say in those circumstances. So this leads to what the great sociologist Irving Goffman called the response cry theory, namely that cathartic swearing is not just reflexive, but it's partly communicative. You signal to a real or virtual audience that you're currently in the throes of a strong emotion. And as such, it's similar to other response cries in the language that are not taboo, such as aha, ouch, whoops, wow, yes, and yuck, each of which also signals the sudden onset of some strong physical or emotional state. So to sum up, or to advertise one's strong reactions to misfortunes. Well, the last part of the talk is language is a window into social relations. And the linguistic puzzle that I'll start with comes from the movie Fargo, in which a kidnapper who has a hostage tied up in the back seat is pulled over by a police officer because he's missing his plates. The officer demands his driver's license. He proffers his wallet with a license showing and a $50 bill extending ever so slightly. And he says to the officer, "I was thinking that maybe the best thing would be to take care of it here in Brainerd," which of course we all recognize as a veiled bribe. Now, this is an example of what linguists call an indirect speech act, a case in which we don't blurt out what we mean in so many words, but we veil our intentions in innuendo, counting on our listener to read between the lines and discern our real intent. And we do this all the time. Example, if you could pass the guacamole, that would be awesome. Now, when you think about it, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, it wouldn't really be awesome. Nonetheless, we understand this as a polite request. Anyone who has sat through a fundraising dinner is familiar with euphemistic schnorring, such as, "We're counting on you to show leadership in our campaign for the future." Translation, "Give us money." Would you like to come up and see my etchings? This has been understood as a sexual come-on for so long that in the 1930s, James Thurber drew a New Yorker cartoon in which a man says to his date, "You wait here and I'll bring the etchings down." Then there's a nice story you got there. It would be a real shame if something happened to it, which any fan of mafia movies recognizes as a veiled threat. So the linguistic puzzle is, why are bribes, requests, seductions, solicitations, and threats so often veiled when presumably both parties know what they mean? And it's, again, not just a scientific puzzle, but it has a great deal of practical importance, such as in the language of diplomacy and politics, and in the prosecution of extortion, bribery, and sexual harassment, which are often couched in innuendo rather than stated baldly. I think it's a complex problem, and I think the solution requires three ideas: the logic of plausible deniability, the logic of relationship negotiation, and the logic of mutual knowledge, which I'll now explain in turn. Let's begin with what game theorists call the identification problem. Namely, how do you figure out the rational course of action when the outcome depends on another rational actor, but you don't know the actor's values? And bribing a police officer is a paradigm case. Imagine that you only had two options: to tender a naked bribe in so many words, or not to say anything at all. What would lead, on average, to the better outcome? Well, the answer is it depends. It depends on what kind of officer you're facing. If you're facing a dishonest officer, that is, if you're lucky, he could accept the bribe and you'd have the very high payoff of going free. If you're unlucky and you're facing an honest officer, he would not only rebuff the bribe, but might arrest you for the crime of attempting to bribe an officer. So if you're comparing the very high payoff of going free with a very high cost of being arrested for bribery, it's not clear how to weigh them against the guaranteed moderate cost of a traffic ticket, which is what you would get with either cop if you just remain silent. But now imagine you had a third option, a veiled bribe, such as I was thinking that maybe the best thing would be to take care of it here. A dishonest officer could sniff out the bribe beneath the innuendo and take the bribe and set you free. An honest officer couldn't make a bribery charge stick in court by the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, so the worst thing you'd get is a traffic ticket. You get the advantage of the high payoff of bribing a dishonest officer, combined with the relatively small cost of failing to bribe an honest officer, combined in a single option, and that makes the veiled bribe the rational choice. Okay, well, that's, I think, what we mean when we talk about plausible deniability. But the puzzle now is, what about non-legal contexts where our words are in no danger of putting us in legal jeopardy, such as when you're tempted to offer a bribe in everyday life? Now, you might say, when would I, a law-abiding, upstanding citizen, ever be tempted to offer a bribe in everyday life? Well, how about this? You want to go to the hottest restaurant in town. You have no reservation. Why not slip the maitre d' a $20 bill in exchange for getting seated immediately and jumping the queue? Well, this was the assignment given to the writer Bruce Feiler by an editor at Gourmet magazine, who dared him to try it at the most exclusive restaurants in Manhattan and to write up his experiences for the pages of the magazine. And as a psychologist, I found this write-up absolutely riveting. First of all, even though, as far as I know, no one has ever gone to jail for the crime of attempting to bribe a maitre d', the task filled him with anxiety. And here's how he began the article. "I am nervous, truly nervous. As the taxi bounces through the trendier neighborhoods of Manhattan, I keep imagining the possible retorts of some incensed maitre d'. What kind of establishment do you think this is? How dare you insult me? Do you think you can get in with that?" Secondly, when he did screw up the courage to offer the bribe, he instinctively did it in indirect speech. Holding the bill in peripheral vision and looking the maitre d' in the eye, he would say something like, "I hope you can fit us in," or "Can you speed up my wait?" or "I was wondering if you might have a cancellation." And the third interesting part of the report was the outcome, which is that it worked every time. As he put it, "We were seated in between 2 and 4 minutes, to the astonishment of my date." Well, this is a puzzle. What are the intangible costs that drive people to indirect speech even when there are no tangible penalties or costs? And here's a theory that the intangible costs come from relationship mismatches, that human relationships fall into a small number of types. Every speech act assumes one of them. Indirect speech is what we use when the relationship type assumed by the speech act differs from the relationship type that currently holds between the speaker and hearer. Let me take a step back. According to the anthropologist Alan Fisk, human relationships all over the world fall into three basic types. Each prescribes a distinct way of distributing resources, each has a distinct evolutionary basis, and each applies most naturally to certain people, but can be extended to others. There's dominance, whose rule is don't mess with me, and which presumably evolved from the dominance hierarchies that are ubiquitous among primates. There's communality, which works by the very different rule, share and share alike, and which, thanks to the evolutionary processes of kin selection and mutualism, applies naturally among biological kin, between spouses, and in circles of close friends. Finally, there's reciprocity, the rule you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, which evolved according to the theory of reciprocal altruism, and which applies to tit-for-tat exchanges of goods and services in more business-like or neighborly relationships. Now, behavior that's acceptable in one relationship type can be highly anomalous in another. For example, at a cocktail party, you might go over to your husband or wife or girlfriend or boyfriend and help yourself to a shrimp off their plate. But you wouldn't go up to your boss and help yourself to a shrimp off his plate, because what you can get away with in a communality relationship, you can't get away with in a dominance relationship. Another example, imagine at the end of a nice dinner party, you pulled out your wallet and offered to pay the host for the meal. Now, that would not be perceived as generous, that would be perceived as crass, because the whole point of a dinner party is to express communality, a setting in which the rules of reciprocity aren't supposed to apply. Now, those are cases where everyone knows what you should do. But in cases where the relationship type is ambiguous, a divergent understanding can lead to an unpleasant emotion that we call awkwardness or embarrassment. For example, there can be awkward moments in a workplace when an employee doesn't know whether to address his boss on a first-name basis or whether he can invite him out after work for a beer, the conflict between dominance and the communal relationship of friendship. It's a well-known bit of good advice that close friends should not engage in a business transaction between them, like one of them selling his car to the other, because the very act of negotiating a price and consummating the transaction can put a strain on the friendship, which is predicated on communality and sharing. The conflict between dominance and sex sets out the battleground of sexual harassment, as when a supervisor solicits sex from a student or an employee. And even the contrast between relationship of friendship and sex gives rise to the anxieties of dating, often grist for the mill of romantic comedies. Well, the upshot is that this gives us a social identification problem where the emotional costs of awkwardness from a relationship mismatch can duplicate the payoff matrix of a legal identification problem that we saw in bribing a cop. And the perfect example is bribing a maitre d', where the possible clash is between the dominance relationship that a maitre d' ordinarily wields over his restaurant fiefdom, according to which he seats people when he chooses, and the reciprocity relationship that you raise by the very nature of the bribe, according to which he'd be obligated to seat you in exchange for accepting the bribe. So once again, if your only choices were to utter a naked bribe or to remain silent, then the outcome very much depends on what kind of maitre d' you're facing. If you're facing a corrupt maitre d', who would consummate the reciprocity relationship, you get the very high cost of a quick table. On the other hand, if you're facing a scrupulous maitre d', who maintained his dominance relationship while you were offering reciprocity by saying something like, what kind of establishment do you think this is? Or how dare you insult me? Or do you think you can get in with that? The result would be the unpleasant emotion of awkwardness. Once again, you have one option that gives you either a high payoff of a quick table or a high cost of awkwardness, and another one which gives you the moderate cost of a long wait with either kind of maitre d'. If you, on the other hand, had the third option of an ambiguous bribe, like I was wondering if you might have a cancellation, the corrupt maitre d' could sniff out the bribe, consummate a reciprocity relationship, and seat you without awkwardness. A scrupulous maitre d' could choose to let it pass, maintain his dominance relationship, and the worst thing you would have is a long wait. Now, there's one remaining problem. Namely, why do we still resort to so much indirectness, even in cases where there is no real uncertainty? For example, when the speaker knows the listener's values. Now, as of tonight, all of you know that 100% of maitre d's are bribeable. Nonetheless, I suspect that if any of you ever tried it, you would still use indirect speech rather than blurting out the quid pro quo. Or conversely, on the other side, what about when the listener knows the speaker's intent? Now, grown-ups aren't naive, and it's hard to imagine any woman who would be fooled by the line about the etchings. Nonetheless, there's something about it that makes things easier all around. What's going on? If the deniability is not really plausible, why should an obvious innuendo still feel more comfortable than a direct overture that is, in some sense, on the record? And I'll illustrate this with a romantic comedy, When Harry Met Sally. From an early scene in which the couple has just met, they are confined to a long car trip together. Harry makes a sexual comment, and Sally says, "You're coming on to me." Harry says, "What do you want me to do about it? I take it back, okay? I take it back." She says, "You can't take it back." He says, "Why not?" She said, "Because it's already out there." And he says, "Oh, geez, what are we supposed to do? Call the cops? It's already out there." Well, this is a puzzle. What is the status of an overture that is out there or on the record that makes it feel so much more awkward than the same proposition conveyed indirectly? And I think the answer comes from a concept much discussed by economists and logicians called mutual knowledge, which has to be distinguished from individual knowledge. In individual knowledge, A knows X and B knows X. In mutual knowledge, A knows X and B knows X. And A knows that B knows X, and B knows that A knows X, and A knows that B knows that A knows X ad infinitum. Well, it turns out that mutual knowledge is qualitatively different from identical individual knowledge. And there are many logical puzzles that illustrate this, but the simplest explanation comes from the story of the emperor's new clothes, which is a story about mutual knowledge. Now, when the little boy said the emperor is naked, he wasn't telling anyone anything that they couldn't see with their own eyeballs. But he was changing the state of their knowledge nonetheless, because as of that moment, everyone now knew that everyone else knew that everyone else knew that the emperor was naked. That gave them the collective power to challenge the dominance of the emperor. So the hypothesis is that innuendos, even obvious ones, merely provide individual knowledge, whereas direct speech provides mutual knowledge, and relationships are maintained or nullified by a mutual knowledge of the relationship type. So if Harry were to say, "Would you like to come up and see my etchings?" and Sally said no, now Sally knows that she's turned down a sexual overture, and Harry knows that she's turned down an overture. But does Sally know that Harry knows? She could be wondering, maybe Harry thinks I'm naive. And does Harry know that Sally knows that Harry knows? He could be wondering, maybe Sally thinks I'm dense. There's no mutual knowledge, and so they can maintain the fiction of a friendship. In contrast, if Harry were to have said, "Would you like to come up and have sex?" Well, now Harry knows that Sally knows that Harry knows that Sally knows. They cannot maintain the fiction of a friendship. And I think that's what's behind the intuition that with direct speech, you can't take it back. It's out there. So to sum up, language is a window into social relationships. People often have to convey messages while unsure of their relationship. Indirect speech can minimize the risks in legal contexts with tangible costs like bribes and threats. And the same thing can happen in everyday life because relationship mismatches have an emotional cost. Also, indirect speech prevents individual knowledge from becoming mutual knowledge, and mutual knowledge is the basis for a relationship. Okay, well, now I'm going to begin the end of my talk. Many psychologists characterize their job in terms of how a Martian biologist would describe our species if he came to Earth without any preconceptions or familiarity with our ways and simply had to characterize us like any other species on Earth. Today's question, in a sense, is how would a Martian linguist describe our species if all he had to go on was the way we use words? Well, I think he could conclude a lot. When it comes to human cognition, he would conclude that humans have an intuitive theory of the physical world. They identify places in space and locate objects relative to them in digital terms. They construe matter as formless stuff or discrete things which are stretched along one or more dimensions. They order and package events in time relative to their own moment of consciousness, and they explain events by identifying their causes, namely an actor that impinges upon an entity. Human intuitive physics differs from real physics, but it helps them to reason and agree about aspects of reality relevant to their purposes, to the causal texture of the environment, to what they can know, change, and will, to how they package and quantify their experience, and to how they assign moral responsibility. Now, humans not only have ideas, but they steep them with emotion. They stand in awe of deities. They are terrified by disease, death, and infirmity. They are revolted by bodily secretions. They loathe enemies, traitors, and subordinate peoples. They are appalled by depraved sexual acts. Despite having negative reactions to so many thoughts, humans willingly inflict those thoughts on one another. To remind them of the unpleasant nature of certain things, to intimidate or denigrate them, to get their attention, or to advertise their reactions to life's misfortunes. Finally, when it comes to social life, humans are very, very touchy about their relationships. With some of their fellows, typically kin, lovers, and friends, humans freely share and do favors. With others, they jockey for dominance, and with still others, they trade goods and services. People distinguish these relationships sharply, and when one person breaches the logic of a relationship with another, they both suffer an emotional cost. Nonetheless, humans often risk these breaches, sometimes to get on with the business of life, sometimes to renegotiate their relationship. Finally, humans think a lot about what other humans think about what they think, and their relationships are ratified by this mutual knowledge. They know that others know that they know what kind of relationship they share. As a result, to preserve their relationships while transacting the business of their lives, humans often engage in hypocrisy and taboo. And those are just some of the ways in which language can serve as a window into human nature. Thank you very much.
Thank you.